Welcome to another episode of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Fasillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, hello, everyone. Happy Random Big 12 Thursday.
Yeah, Random Big 12 Thursday. There's a god-awful Mississippi State-Missouri game nobody's watching.
Is that on now? Did that start already?
It is on now.
Oh, boy. Can't wait to for that. The highlights of that 17-3 game. It's going to be great.
Somebody was joking about the real possibility that 4-3 might be the final score.
No, I trust Dak to put up a not impressive, but plenty to win point total. Because Missouri's just so bad. Missouri, I think, like, aren't they, like, ranked below? I think they're ranked below Syracuse in, like, F+.
They are. What happened to what happened to Matty Mock?
Aside from getting a mystery suspension for almost the whole year, he was good 2 years ago. Last year he was pretty terrible, and this year he was pretty terrible. I don't know. Matty Mock's a mystery for like a thousand reasons.
Yeah, I Missouri, and like it's funny because I feel like, granted, two division titles are something to. To champion, like, how many division titles did Missouri win in the Big 12? Is the answer one?
I will let you know in a second. How long did they have divisions in the Big 12?
15 years, I think.
It was that long? Missouri had three Big 12 North titles, 07, 08, and 2010. So, some prime Blaine Gabbert real estate there, I think.
So actually, when you think about it, Missouri, since divisional play became popularized in the early 90s, Missouri might be one of the better teams in the country when it comes to winning divisions.
Yeah, well, because they always did put in the worst one. Because well, who was in true. The Big 12 North for that stretch? I don't even remember how it was broken down. Like
Nebraska. And Colorado. And Kansas State.
Yeah, but this was like... Callahan, Nebraska.
Yeah, that's true. You had the tail end of Prince, K-State. You had Callahan, Kansas, Nebraska.
Which I guess Kansas is better than some of those other teams for like a minute there.
There was that insane 2007 season that featured KU and Mizzou with national title implications.
RIP that rivalry. Oh, more for hoops. Yeah, and Colorado and not the Big 12 North, not the sexiest group of teams. Iowa State, I'm guessing, was in the Big 12 North.
I would get actually. Wait, Wikipedia says they didn't win in 2010.
Really? I'm seeing Missouri.
That's what Wikipedia could be wrong. A Nebraska fan could have hijacked this thing.
Nebraska, and they, I guess Nebraska probably won the head-to-head and went to the title.
Oh, there you go.
They technically split the, I guess technically because they both have the same conference record, they split it.
See, but, like, I would contend that, like, in the last decade, Missouri's probably won more division titles than, like, almost every team in the country.
Aside from, I'm sure Florida got a lot.
In the last 10 years, though?
Let's look.
Look, just the last decade of football, Missouri is probably Alabama, maybe, but like
here's how you know the difference between Missouri and Florida football, like on a grander scale. Missouri's sidebar on Wikipedia does list their division titles, and Florida's does not. So I have to go digging a little bit more here for yearly. Stuff.
Well, let's see. Alabama's in the last decade, Alabama's won four division titles.
So if we're not taking the bogus tie, so they and Mizzou are tied.
Yeah, tied's dead even with Missouri. And then Pac-12 hasn't had them long enough. Big Ten hasn't either.
All right. So Florida has won the big. Hold on, the SEC. They're not. Good Lord, the SEC East. What's the metric we're going by here?
Well, I think we're going since 05.
Since 05, they won it outright three times. 06, 08, 09. And, yeah. George's, and then this year they're going to win it again. So
there you go. George's got three. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, so
Thacker lined out one of those.
Missouri and Alabama are the two most successful teams in the last decade of divisional college football play.
Yeah, because the Big Ten hasn't had it long enough, because they just switched the divisions when they went leaders and legends for a year.
That said, Wisconsin's probably got at least two.
Sounds right.
We forgot the ACC. That was awful, actually.
Does anyone have enough? I guess Florida State is a bunch.
Florida State and Virginia Tech are probably up there.
Yeah, because the Coastal kind of rotates around teams not named Miami. So,
Florida State since 2005, which is the first year. Florida State's won the whole thing four times. They've been there five. Virginia Tech has been there five times, won it twice. Okay, so ACC teams, by default, they're just better because there's only like four of them that actually
yes.
get into
ACC this game. Teams are always better than SEC and 12. And Big Ten and Pac-12. That's just a fact. We all know it. Anything to the contrary is SEC ESPN media bias. Am I doing this right?
Yes, that's exactly what you All right. So while I was typing something on Slack about Charlie Loeb, as one does. We're talking about Syracuse football.
Talking about the Cuse.
Surprisingly to most, it is almost 7 minutes in, and we have yet to mention the Orange. But here we are. SU's 3-5. That's unfortunate. I don't really think we expected to be 4-4 today anyway. At least as of the last podcast, I don't think that was something that was really on the board as an opportunity. But just the same, bummer to see how it happened. Obviously, we discussed this all around Slack in the comments section, but it just sucked to see a team that looked like they were kind of hanging around the beginning of the game. To see them just get kind of laid to waste in the second half, real depressing. Dan, what would you say was the biggest problem for you starting, let's go with about midway through the second quarter?
Oh, midway through the second quarter, so that doesn't count Travis Rudolph looking like
no.
Yeah,
no,
okay.
No.
not to belabor that. Obviously, there's the clock stuff, which is just an ongoing storyline that I wish the writers of the ACC would get off of. I just think, like, in general, the tackling has been suspect all year. And obviously, Florida State has really good athletes, but, like, we caught the most vulnerable Florida State will ever be. And we made them look we made them look very good. We actually have started a quarterback controversy in Tallahassee, so that's probably not the best thing we could have done, considering, you know, Sean McGuire apparently was I don't know, the coaches seem to think Sean McGuire is like way better than Everett Dolson, which maybe, but for, you know, I trust Jimbo Fisher's judgment on that more than I trust Bulla's. But I guess I understand it from the point that Sean McGuire just absolutely lit up Syracuse, and it was only his second start in his career and looked like a 3-year vet. So, yeah, that's a concern. You think when you have a team going without its quarterback who hasn't been great but has been, you know, pretty decent game manager-y all year, and without the running back who is really should be getting more Heisman buzz. The only reason he's not is because Leonard Fournette devours worlds at the same position. But Dalvin Tort's probably been one of the five best players in college football this year, easily. So neither of those guys play, and Florida State looks just as good or better than you could have expected. So, yeah, not great. Not that we expected to win, but we expected it to be a pretty competitive game if you listened last week, and it really wasn't after, like, midway through the third quarter.
Yeah, and you know what, like, the time stuff sucks, the squib kick stuff sucks. I think that what really killed me, though, is just once again for the third straight game, you know, SU's offense didn't score a touchdown in the second half. It's frustrating to see a team that just bogs itself down. I know I dove into some of it in the play calling breakdown. People were quick to kind of point out Dungy had a poor game, you know, after the first watch. And you know what? I bought in, and I know that, like, this isn't even to start talking shit. I think that a lot of people had some questions about Dungy. I mean, even Sean said, you know, in the first recap out of three that we had up on the site after the game, that, like, you know, this was Dungy's first, like, bad game. You look at that replay, though. I mean, yes, there were things he could have done better. There's always things that every quarterback could have done better. Dungy really couldn't have done much more, though, given what he was handed. And considering that, like, what the final result was, I mean, what was he like? I think it was, like, 11 of 23 with a fumble, I think less than 150 yards. At the all in all, he didn't really do anything to hurt the team. And I think that that's what – I don't want to sound like, you know, a Dungy apologist. It's just more of a – You watch what he does and the decisions he makes, and you saw him trying to make the same quick reads, and he simply couldn't do it. And it wasn't because of a lack of ability; it was because of a lack of who was out there and who was available to get passes to. I mean, FSU might be the best secondary SUCs all season. I have a feeling Clemson might challenge that assessment, but you know, receivers were blanketed, and you look at the tape from the week before. If they were trying to repeat it. I mean, Dungy pretty much targeted the same four guys over and over again. Becomes difficult to do that very same thing if you're just going to if you're going to face a secondary as good as Florida State's is.
Yeah, for sure. And obviously, Dungy is going to have games like this. This is probably the first where he really, like, struggled. Even statistically, it wasn't very pretty. Although he did have our two only touchdowns, so even when nothing's going well for Syracuse, like, Dungy's still the only guy who is getting any kind of big production. I guess you can say George Morris had a nice game too, which, you know, averaged 9 yards a carry, so that's good. But yeah, the Florida State secondary is very good. Our receivers, while they have talent, just not on the level where we're going to really be super competitive on like a one-on-one basis. So you'd hope that we'd have ways to steam guys open more, but really all around, not the best effort, although I am willing to, you know, concede that Florida State is Florida State, even on a down year compared to what they've been. So maybe not the, you know, end of the world. Obviously, it wasn't 59-3, which is good, but you'd hope that when a team is as beat up as Florida State is, Syracuse would go and at least try to show that they could hang with the, you know, 1.5, like the first/second teams of a Florida State when things are about as awry as they can go for the Seminoles. And, you know, one team didn't miss a beat and the other one looked as confused as they have all year. So hopefully it was more of an FSU having talent thing than it was a Syracuse continuing to struggle thing. But I have a feeling it's a little bit from both.
Yeah, I think you're very right there. And, you know, it was something I didn't point out in the long recap that I put up on Saturday evening. But, you know, if you want to look at the margin here, I mean, this is a step back from last season. And that's without Jameis Winston, without a ton of NFL draft picks. Granted, there's a lot more that replaced them. But, I mean, the final score of this game was truly 45-14, not 21. And that's not to take away anything from Brizzly. I'd like to find a balance between telling Brizzly he did a great job on that return and also chalking it up to garbage time and fatigue. In general, you know, this is a team that lost by basically 31. It's a season after they lost, you know, by 18. And I think last year we saw it as an improvement. This year, I think it was a step back. You know, we allowed almost 600 yards of total offense, and you know, 400 of those in the first half. FSU didn't really hold the ball any longer than we did. FSU averaged, you know, over 9 yards per completion. They averaged 6.5 yards per rush, and that was before we even got to garbage time again. I mean, other than those first maybe two drives of the game, and then probably that second to last FSU drive in the second quarter, the Noles had us figured out, and then some. I think it goes to show, this isn't to hammer, you know, the coaching staff, but more to just say, like, this defense needs to have more complicated things to it than just blitz a lot. And I think that that's where, you know, you're starting to see teams not just the FSUs and the Clemsons of the world, but, you know, the Central Michigans of the world for part of a game, the USFs of the world for a full game, figured out this defense pretty easily. And that's, I think, what worries me most of all, is if you're going to have your calling card be your defense, there's got to be some more nuance to it, and I'm not seeing it right now.
Yeah, it makes me wonder if maybe the scheme after, you know, here in the third year of Bulla, and, you know, we always say it's not that much different than what we saw from Schaefer as defensive coordinator. It makes me wonder if things have kind of gotten stale. The havoc rate this year, defensive line's pretty good, secondary's pretty average, but the linebackers, linebacker blitzes have been a staple of this team for a while, and on paper we have a lot of speed at the position, and we had like five or six guys who personally I thought were all pretty good players and thought the linebackers would be a strength, but this year we've seen some issues with tackling, we've seen some big time penalties even from guys like Zaire Franklin, who are, you know, leaders of the team, and we're just not getting much production from them as blitzers or as disruptive players, which is something I thought, you know, would be one of the things that allowed this defense to thrive this year. But instead, we have a very exposed middle of the defense, I think, which most of the heat's gone to the DBs, but I don't think we've gotten a lot of help from the blitzing or the pass rush, especially after, like, the first quarter. I feel like to open games, we get after quarterbacks, but once the game gets towards the end, I don't know if we just tire out or if teams find blocking schemes that work against our specific stunts and everything, but we're really struggling to make big plays in the fourth quarter, and I think some of that comes from the linebackers and the defensive ends not making not sacking the quarterback, and that's something that we've been relying on for a couple of years now.
Yeah, and I didn't look at the full numbers, but I would assume over the last 3 weeks, I can only remember maybe three sacks over the last three games or so, maybe four, and I think part of that is due to, you know, just the amount of pressure and stress put on the defensive line. I mean, these guys aren't having bad games. Like, Ron Thompson is putting in work. I think you're seeing, you know, in general, we're finding ways to plug gaps in the middle. It's that the linebackers are being asked to do a little too much. They're not great in coverage yet. I think that, you know, Paris Bennett has put in some great work, and it's a shame he'll miss this game this weekend, but on the positive end, I am looking forward to seeing, you know, what Thomas does in that same spot. I think that he seemed to put in some great work in relief. Granted, some of it was garbage time last Saturday, but he's somebody who I've always thought is one of the better athletes on the team and just hasn't really had the playing time granted to him. So I'm curious what he does, you know, for this Orange team. In general, though, yeah, we're seeing a lot of pressure put on the front seven, and not really enough execution on their end either. So I think it's not to absolve them of a fault here. I think there's definitely some issues with the scheme and their talent level to be addressed. But in general, you know, this is definitely something that, you know, we're going to have to try to tip the scales in one way or the other. Either you're going to be a group that doesn't rush the passer a ton and relies on the secondary, or you've got to be a group that rushes the passer a ton and takes the pressure off the secondary, because the lack of success in terms of havoc, which is an empty concept for us at this point, and in terms of turnovers, is really exposing just the entire defense, you know, front to back.
Yeah, I'm actually looking up the sacks now. It appears that we did not have a sack in the second half of Florida State, and we did not have a sack in the second half of Pitt. And I'm going through the other play-by-plays now. But that's not great, because when getting pressure is a mainstay of your defense, when you could just totally lose an aspect like that at, you know, whether it's halftime or just the fourth quarter, that just doesn't work. Especially with, you know, all the very well-documented secondary issues that we've had. It looks like we had a couple sacks against Virginia, but obviously they're not quite the same team as... They had two sacks in the second half against Virginia. I think they were both in the third quarter as well. So even that game could not get a big play down the stretch, and obviously we all know how that game ended. So Definitely something to think about. And I know depth at defensive on the defensive line is probably part of that issue, but I think it's you know, the whole defense is kind of responsible for that. And hopefully we find some ways to make up for it, because right now we're just seeing the same issues week in and week out, which is not great.
Yeah, so that's not good. And I think maybe moving to some positive things, the Louisville game this Saturday, you know, I think we could talk about the Noles game all day. And yes, that was a subtle talk about the Noles mention. But what I think is going to be tough this coming weekend is, you know, A, who's going to be playing quarterback? I'm pretty sure it's going to be Lamar Jackson, and to me that's worrisome, especially if he's at close to full strength, because we just haven't played well against mobile quarterbacks, especially when you have, you know, a linebacker turned defensive end who's out in, you know, Arcenega, and then you have another, you know, linebacker in Bennett who's out. I'm getting worried about Jackson. I think he's going to be able to really tear us up in that front. And now that you have, you know, a couple key players in that secondary out too, I just think we're starting to get too banged up for our own good, and that's not encouraging for a team that's 3-5.
No, it's definitely not the same injuries that we had last year, which were obviously we kind of threw the year out because of them. At least I was willing to kind of dismiss them if this year ended up being a bounce back, which to be determined, but not looking great. But I agree on Jackson. Louisville really hasn't found a quarterback that works consistently. But I think Jackson, you at least know that you have a dynamic runner. And it's not like Reggie Bonifant was so good at throwing the ball that it really makes a huge difference there. So, and the Syracuse team, in years past, we've had a penchant for making young quarterbacks look really, really good, especially when we haven't faced them before.
Teddy Bridgewater.
So,
well Teddy turned into an NFL. I get that, but I think that what we did,
we also beat him.
Did we? I thought his first game was the. Well, we beat him later, but in his first game against us, was a complete disaster.
Was he?
Like his second, maybe his second or third game, back in 2011.
Oh, you might be right. Yeah. Well, at least we came back and beat him. I'm thinking of like
fully established. BJ Daniels. I'm sure if we looked up, I'm surprised in my like typical off season and season long like dives into bad shit that happens to us. Like I didn't uncover the. How does SU fare against QBs in their first career start?
This actually wasn't Bridgewater's first or second start. It was like his, I mean, I don't know if he started all these games before, but he had at least like 18 passes in the five games before that, but he did beat Syracuse 24-17. I don't remember too much about the specifics of that game, but he had two touchdowns, no picks, 198 yards. So I try to wash away the end to that season, because happened after the game. We finished with 5 wins. We finished 5-2, so they couldn't send us to a bowl, and that's my story. They're like, we really want you to go because you're really good, but we can't because you only played 7
we won the Fiesta Bowl against West Virginia that season.
The Fiesta Bowl at the Carrier Dome on a Friday.
There was a sandstorm in Phoenix, so they had to keep us in.
There were at least multiple people had to be eating Tostitos at that game, so.
Maybe it was the Las Vegas Bowl, because that's all I remember about that game, is that I was in Vegas.
Oh, good times. I was there. That was a fun game. We thought we were going to go to the BCS. We thought we were legitimately going to the BCS after that. Not the national title, but we thought we were winning the Big East and going to like the Fiesta Bowl. So, and that didn't happen.
Oh, the things that occurred next. Not great.
No, it was a long off season. But then we went back into 8 games the next year.
Yeah, and it was all good.
That was happier times.
So, yeah, defensively, I think we kind of got covered that we're in a rough spot. But offensively, I mean, Dan, what's the missing piece here? I mean, I rewatched the games. I have some thoughts on what the missing piece is. To you, what does this team need to do in the second half that it either does in the first half or needs to do more of in the second half? I guess, what is it that we need to kind of, you know, figure out to get this offense scoring and not just moving the football?
Part of it's having the ball. Obviously, we cover that all the time. The defense doesn't get off the field. Otherwise, I just think we need to always stay committed to getting the ball into the best players' hands. We just get away from that so often. And we saw some good things in the Pitt game. And then against FSU, I don't know if everyone was just totally locked up, but how many runs did Fredericks have? Like, I think he got out-touched by multiple people. We struggled to get the ball to Irv. So I don't know if this was just FSU taking away everything or just us falling back into the trap of trying to spread the ball so much. But when we're only getting like 60 plays a game, which is really low and way below what I believe that the offense wants, the fact we can't like get cute with giving random people touches, but like our leader in receptions with Josh Paris, who I think is pretty good, but no one else, the only other person who had three catches was Irv, and he went for a grand total of -1 yards, and then everyone else on the team had one catch. So like, eventually there are ways to get your receivers open, even if it's just a few yards down the field, and build up your quarterback's confidence, and we just did not appear to do any of that, like we were in the beginning of the Pitt game. So hopefully just a consistent flow of play calling and, you know, going back to the things that work just seems to be a struggle at times for this team.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? I actually thought that the offensive line did a fantastic job in that game, all things considered. You know, Florida State's obviously got some better athletes out there. And, oh, dear God. Sorry. Interrupting because that Coleman catch was insane.
Yes. Corey Coleman's did a football everywhere.
Very. Back to your regularly scheduled programming. The offensive line really held up pretty well, all things considered. I thought they faced a good amount of pressure. Again, better athletes, more speed on the outside. And overall, I mean, other than that, you know, two sacks on second and third down drive in the third quarter, I believe. Maybe it was the early fourth. SU's line held up pretty well. It's just that there was nobody open. And I thought that's something that they should definitely be commended for. But yeah, if you have time to throw, but you're not getting looks, then that's when you're going to run, you know, more short patterns, have some more misdirection. I felt like we really didn't use enough of that in particular. And it's something that worked for us a lot in other games is a lot of motion, a lot of misdirection, have, you know, multiple guys kind of in short crossing routes. These were things that just, you know, didn't occur. And that's how you end up with, you know, Paris catching 5 passes, you know, Phillips getting 3 balls from -1. We're looking at, you know, I saw one unblocked bubble screen. I was going to cry as I recall things of past teams that none of us want to recall ever again. In general, I didn't think the game plan was tailored to do much but move the ball up and down the field and maybe not score. And maybe that's not just against FSU. Maybe that's just kind of something I've had in the back of my mind for weeks now. But Dan, I guess you and I have been shouting for Dante Strickland to get more involved. Are you happy with what he's done here? Do you think that his emergence that we kind of saw coming and expected to come, do you think that changes Ben Lewis's role on this team?
I just don't see why they play the same position. I mean, I understand it's kind of a labeling thing.
They're not the same player.
I feel, yeah, they're so different in terms of their abilities that if it changes Ben Lewis's role, it's because Ben Lewis was in the wrong role. Ben Lewis is a nice split blocker out wide, short pass receiver, kind of like a wide receiver tight end hybrid, while Dante Strickland is more of the Irv Phillips type coming out of the backfield. Obviously, I'm happy with him outrunning the FSU defense for a 62-yard dean to set up the first touchdown. But I would love to see him get more than five touches. Another guy who I understand you have to get Fredericks and Phillips theirs first, and they should be getting more as well. But Strickland, I think, is a guy that, for whatever reason, he seems to have a nose for the end zone. He stored an inordinate amount of his touches and came very close against Florida State. I just think he's kind of a game-breaking talent, and the fact that it seems like we have him in this like emergency case, and we break him out like once a half for a big play instead of, you know, working him into the offense. It's like a surprise when he gets the ball, and good things happen at a really high percentage compared to the rest of the team. So I would love for him to get on the field more and not be afraid to use him as much as we use anyone else. But I think a lot of this still boils down to the team just not getting a lot of plays. Like, the offense just doesn't get to run enough to really get the amount of touches for everyone that we want. And obviously some of that's because of defensive struggles. But I kind of wish we would kind of start hurrying up a little bit more just to manufacture some extra plays, because this doesn't seem like an issue that's going away.
Right. And you know what? I think that kind of hits a nail on the head. We're just not running enough plays. It doesn't seem, I mean, I think we would have had 64 plays or so on 14 drives against Florida State. That's just laughable when you look at just, we weren't moving the ball. When we were moving it very quickly. And it was another conversation that was going on Slack today, was just in general, we're doing a lot of, we're having a lot of explosive plays. But then we're not countering those with productive plays on top of it. And productive, I'd say, you're looking at like gains in the 4 to 6 yard range versus an explosive play, you're looking at 15 yards or more. Last year we saw this even more so, where we'd have, you know, 11 to 12 explosive plays, but then we'd also counter that with, you know, a 1.7 yards per play average for the other plays. This year, I think we're sitting around 2.4 to 2.7 yards per play. Outside those explosive plays, we're still averaging about 12 to 13 explosive plays a game. That percentage of the total is larger, but the gains aren't larger because we have, you know, less plays from scrimmage. I think a guy like Strickland, we do kind of keep him under a glass case for an odd reason, seems like a perfect match. I mean, he's got three touchdowns on like 12 touches and another one that would have been a touchdown. He's basically Irv Phillips with another, 20 pounds on him and another 2 inches, and he's super quick. He just really knows how to move with the football in his hands, both at the line of scrimmage and once he's in the open field. I mean, he had some great blocking on that 62-yard reception, but in general, it was his speed and size that was helping him move down the field at a rapid pace and outrunning, you know, a very fast FSU secondary.
Yeah, he has three touchdowns total on 18 total touches. So that's pretty good. Like, that's a guy you want to have touch the ball more than three times a game. And he has 174 total yards. So he's averaging a shade under 10 yards every time he gets the ball. And obviously that's a small sample size. But why is it a small sample size? Like, why aren't we seeing... This is crazy. It's not like it's one or two plays. It's enough now where you're saying, hey, maybe this is a thing that could be a trend, but you're not allowing yourself to find out. So I don't know. I don't know why he doesn't get the ball more. I don't know. He doesn't even seem to be on the field enough. Obviously, I don't have the exact I don't have exactly how many plays everyone's getting every game.
But the numbers aren't high all around. And I think we're looking at a team that honestly has the pieces to play with a lot of tempo. And if we were playing at the same tempo that we were in 2012, and it's not to start bringing up this comparison, but if we were playing with a similar tempo as we were in 2012, this team would be putting up more points. They'd have more touches to go around. We'd have a lot of really, really promising pieces. And we still do. But this is the type of team that really, really, especially now that Dungy's, you know, getting smarter about when he takes off and when he throws the ball. This is a team with probably four or five guys at least. I mean, Strickland gets buried for no reason. When Ben Lewis gets back, he'll probably get buried. guy like Jamal Custis, who, you know, is a freak athlete who we could use in a variety of different roles. All these guys get buried, and it's problematic for us, you know, as an offense to have all these pieces that we're not doing anything with, because when you only have 50, 60 plays, you know, they're just, you know, Dungy's going to run 5 to 7 times. Okay, you know, Fredericks needs the ball about 10 times at least. Handoff. You know that Morris and McFarland are usually going to get, you know, 5 to 7 combined carries. You already just took up half the plays on just a few guys, and you know, SU just, if they just play with a little bit more tempo, even just shaving 5 seconds off, you know, plays, oh, just off the play clock in general, you'd find, you know, an offense that might be a little bit crisper, might get more people involved, that might get more plays and more chances to score.
Yep. And it just, like, it's frustrating because I think we both agree that this offense probably has more potential than what we've seen outside of, like, 2012. And obviously youth is a factor, and we have repeatedly have these issues where it seems like the team is confused or tired or whatever, and that's led to some of the timeout calls that people have debated from Schaefer. But I just wish we would say, you know, let's see what happens if we really put the pedal to the floor here and just start running and let the talent try to win out rather than trying to outsmart people or let the trust the defense, whatever that means, that strange platitude that we fall into all the time. I want to see the offense go out and win games, and for a multitude of reasons, both within and beyond our control, we're not allowing that to happen. When this offense, you know, statistically, it doesn't look all that gaudy, but if you watch it, like, it's something's there. It's just not quite hitting the level in which you see the light go on and say, oh, this is something that can be pretty special. It's like, it's definitely doesn't have the same issues as last year where you could see mechanically things were broken. It's just, like, we can't quite reach that level of that competency where things just roll like they did in 2012, where team by the halfway through the year, no one could stop the offense. So I feel like we're not that far away, and hopefully we can flip it on, kind of like in 2012 when we were facing a similar, I don't know if we were 3-5, but we were in a similar spot in terms of our record.
We were 4-5 before we faced Louisville that year.
There we go. You know, I know we've internally had kind of some thoughts about comparing these two teams. And obviously that one had a lot of seniors and was in an easier league and all that. But it'd be nice to see a similar mid-season turnaround. And some of that was the offense hitting another gear, simplifying things, going to what works more. I don't think the power run game is going to be that like it is like it was that year with Jerome Smith. But a nice midseason adjustment where we kind of exemplify the things that work best would be a really good thing for this team. And I think manufacturing more plays on the field is part of that. So we'll see how things go. Louisville's a kind of an interesting opponent because they have their own serious struggles. I'm not sure if they're the best one to be playing right now, but with their quarterback issues, you know, it wouldn't be the craziest thing for SC to go steal one.
Yeah, and I would completely agree. But why don't we take a little halftime, and then a little bit past halftime, but still. A little halftime, a little beer. What have you been drinking, Dan?
It's been kind of a mediocre week, just a lot of what's been around the fridge. So just kind of the standard, some a little bit of Southern Tier stuff, some Captain Lawrence. Nothing I haven't, you know, talked about before at length, so not the most interesting week, although hopefully that starts to turn around a little bit as it gets a little cooler and we have, you know, some more trips to the bar now that it, well, actually this week it's been kind of warm in the Northeast compared, but it was like 40 a couple weeks ago, now it was like 70 yesterday. So once we get back to normal temperature, I think we'll be kind of indoors a little more and a little more drinking time.
Fair enough. Yeah, for me, had some of the first bottles of Duet from Alpine that were brewed at Green Flash. Can't say I'm a fan. I mean, it's still a good beer. It's just, it's dropped off a bit. I won't go into that whole thing, because especially on the Pacific Forum and Beer Advocate, you'll definitely find a lot of people who have some serious issues with Green Flash taking over at Alpine. Some other things that I was drinking. We have Buffalo Bill's American's Original Pumpkin Ale. It's a George Washington's recipe for pumpkin ale. And really, really good stuff. Probably one of the better pumpkin beers I've had outside of Pumpkin. What else? Oh, I was at Smog City, as I find myself at least a couple times a month. Had a Bony Knuckle from them. It was kind of a Mexican Imperial Stout. Really good. Had their Quat Saison, which I've had before, but really, really enjoyable Saison. It kind of almost comes off a sour, which is really nice. Had Monkish's Oxford Comma. It's a Belgian Pale Ale, and a nice little nod to both the quirky, grammatical comma, as well as to Vampire Weekend, for people who are fans of said band. And I also had Happy Birthday from Alpine. That was also brewed a Green Flash this time around. And yeah, didn't really drop off as much as Duet, but still wasn't a huge fan. And plenty to drink this weekend, I am sure.
I hope we start a raging Oxford comma debate in the comments.
If this was every day, it should be Saturday. The debate would already be 1,500 comments long. As Ryan Nanny once said, I forgot, this was like a couple years ago, actually. I don't know why I remember this one fact from a podcast, for a Shutdown Fullcast. It was something like, if you left the comment section over there alone, they would be arguing the merits of ketchup on a hot dog for decades.
I think that's just the only reason they write any articles anymore. They just need to turn a new thread over just so that people can get out of the, like, just ridiculousness that occurs in there. I try to look every so often, and, like, I just get lost. There's just too much. It's totally intimidating, and I respect anyone who can actually follow what happens in the EDSBS comments beyond, like, one little, like, 10-comment thread.
Yeah, I show up every so often. I used to be there more. I remember in particular there was, like, one ridiculous... There was a couple different ones about sorting Power Five schools into different Hogwarts houses that I actually initiated, and that went for a good 700 comments or so. I'll usually show, like, I knew I showed up after Kentucky lost to Wisconsin in the Final Four last year, just because I was in Indianapolis hotel room, I had nothing else to do, so I had some fun with that.
I mean, judging by my knowledge of EDSBS stuff, Syracuse would probably end up in Hufflepuff because of the anti-Syracuse conspiracy.
We were in Hufflepuff, actually.
Oh, God. That's unfortunate.
Yeah. All right. Why don't we... I know we're both watching Big 12 football. Why don't we talk a little bit about the college football playoff rankings? SU fans, you should be interested in this in one way or another. I thought it was an entertaining article the other day about a very, very, very off chance that SU could find itself in the top 25 of said rankings if, you know, a million different things happen, but spelled it out in detail more or less of how it could occur. But looking at these opening rankings, Dan, what sticks out to you as the most egregious, not error, because these rankings don't matter, but what's the most egregious just issue or nit to pick with the committee after 1 week?
Obviously everyone's pointing to Alabama being four, and it just doesn't seem like there's real consistency with the reasoning for various things. Like, I'm fine with someone thinking Alabama is one of the four best teams in football. They very likely are. I just don't get how you put them there now, and I'm totally, like, not getting too worked up about it, because the reason they do these rankings every week is because everyone argues about them every week, and it's really good for debate and driving discussion about college football, which, as a college football writer, I am all for. So get really worked up, everyone else. I'm happy about that. But no, I think the Alabama complaints are pretty legit because I don't quite get how they justify it, but whatever. And then on the same end, TCU is quite low, and you can say TCU's looked sloppy here and there, but literally every team in that top like eight has looked sloppy at some point. Like, there's not one of those teams that is put together a bunch of flawless performances. Ohio State obviously looked like pretty mediocre for half the year until maybe the last 2 weeks, and now they lost their quarterback, which obviously the committee doesn't seem to care about based on last year, and they said that they don't care about it when referring to Seth Russell this year. There are schedule issues with some teams that'll work themselves out as the Big 12, you know, starts to get into the meat of what they're doing, since they totally backloaded everything in a most comical fashion. Otherwise, I mean, I think Clemson's fine at number one. They have a couple great wins. They've looked pretty dominant for a month. Overall, it's just always important to remember that they throw these things out the day after every week and strap it and do it all again. So no real use in getting too mad until December, but it is what it is. This is going to be how college football goes from here on out, and the fact that people get really worked up is the exact reason why.
Yeah, and you know what? Like, at first I was pissed off about Alabama, but in general, like, what pisses me off isn't the order of, well, it is the order of the teams in some ways, but more than that, it's the process and the inconsistency of said process. This is, they mentioned the weather for the Clemson-Notre Dame game, which I just felt is like, it's not a factor. They mention Baylor and TCU's style of play over Iowa's, which shouldn't be a factor if you win. And again, others have said this too, but, you know, it's an infinite feedback loop the way they do things. These rankings are legitimized by themselves because you look at a loss, you go, oh, well, this team lost to the number three team. Like, well, that team's the number three team because you said they were. So, like, there has to be something else that these are based on, and any sort of advanced metric would be much, much preferred. I mean, whether it's F+ or Sagarin or whatever it is. An RPI type number would be great to take a look at here. Because what we have now is just a weird, again, it's a feedback loop that doesn't really have any consistency. Alabama and Iowa have beaten the same team. Iowa on a road field, and Alabama at a neutral site. Alabama also has a loss. The team that Alabama lost to also lost to Memphis. Memphis is undefeated, but they're nine spots below Alabama. Like, Stanford being as low as they are, there's not enough here. Like, you look at these rankings, and there's problematic pieces of thinking. And to me, this is even worse than the BCS, quote-unquote, getting it wrong, because the intent here is to get it, is supposedly to get it right and to do it better than the BCS, and I don't necessarily think it's doing that.
Well, I mean, it has the inherent advantage of having two extra teams, so it's always better to strew the number five, the number four team than the, or the number five team, I guess, than the number three. But yeah, it's iffy, and part of the problem is this year has been so crazy that there are still teams that are undefeated and so many one-loss teams who are in the conversation. Like, at this time last year, obviously things got totally erased from that because the first foursome was Mississippi State, Ole Miss, Auburn, and Florida State. But even at that time, there were only like two undefeated teams, I think. I think there were the two Mississippi schools, or no, it was Mississippi State and Auburn, and Ole Miss beat Alabama. But it just seemed like things were already a little more figured out at that time. And obviously they have the three SEC schools, but you kind of knew it was going to work itself out. This year, there's just so much, like, there's just a giant cluster in, like, the top 12 or so that I can understand why it's difficult to rank them. But, you know, I get it. Like, I get why it makes it hard. But that being said, I don't think things are explained all that well, especially, like, when Jeff Lawn cites, like, a storm for why Notre Dame gets the benefit of the doubt. But wouldn't the storm, like, A, you could say the storm makes that game harder to judge, but then Clemson would probably lose points. But then wouldn't the storm for Wazoo Stanford have the same effect on Stanford as it does for Clemson? And Wazoo is also a pretty decent team. So I don't know. I agree. There seems to be some issues with consistency in terms of how they figure things. I trust that we'll have enough figured out with direct on-the-field results by the end that it won't be too much of a cluster, but I guess we'll figure it out because it's not like we have a ton of data to fall back on. Like, oh, they get it right all the time. Like, it's been 1 year. So hopefully they don't royally screw it up and make everyone long for the BCS, because I think the BCS is pretty horrible. But it definitely leaves something to be desired. And I feel like there just has to be a way they could simplify this all. And, you know, whether it's just expanding and having automatic bids or something, and then maybe just figuring out one at large based on some stat, even if it's slightly flawed, at least you kind of know what you're working with. So I think there's some good points there. It's just, you know, hopefully by December, stuff kind of works itself out and makes it pretty easy on the committee, because I don't totally trust them to make the best choices when it gets to there. But hopefully they won't have to.
Yeah, I mean, and in general, like, you and me and pretty much everybody else was rooting for chaos, and we said, you know, the more undefeated teams, the better, the more unbeaten, you know, group of five teams, the better. And right now we have that. I think that, you know, and this, a lot of this will work itself out, and I think that's what everyone should keep in mind, and is I think, especially as among writers, seems to be keeping in mind. I mean, you look at this top 10 right off the bat. I mean, one of LSU and Alabama has to lose at least one more time. One of Ohio State and Michigan State has to lose at least one more time. Same goes for Baylor and TCU. On top of the Ohio State and Michigan State mentions, Iowa has to lose, or, you know, one of those three teams has to lose at least once more. Same thing goes for Florida, you know, after the LSU-Alabama. Like, there's enough here that says most of this sorts itself out. The only things you can probably bank on are that, you know, if Clemson wins this weekend, that's over. That's locked up. You're looking at Clemson. They might not be the number one when it's all said and done, but Clemson could find itself, very well find itself, in, you know, with a victory this weekend, just because of the upcoming schedule. And yes, I'm aware that includes Syracuse. And then everybody else really is going to have to fight it out. In the couple games that you look at right away, the Ohio State-Michigan State game in, I think, a week or two, the LSU-Alabama game this coming weekend, the Notre Dame-Stanford game close to the end of the year, Utah kind of lurking. If Utah can run the table and then beat Stanford in a Pac-12 championship game, I think Utah has the potential to be this year's Ohio State. I mean, yes, their loss was later in the year, and it was also to a better team, to be honest, than last year's Hokies. I think Trojans are probably could be an 8-win team despite the tumultuous, you know, season it seems like they've had. So I think Clemson's a good bet, and I guess I'll use that as a jumping off point, Dan, to who do you think who's your top four now, and who do you think the top four is at the end of the year?
I like the top three they have. I think Clemson, LSU is probably the correct top two. I'm fine with Ohio State being in there, just because I do think that they seem to have figured something out with Barrett, and I do not expect Barrett to miss more than one game, and I don't expect the game that he misses to be a big deal. Personally, I think I'd stick... it's tough between TCU and Baylor. I think those two, obviously, they're in just forever paired together. Baylor's defense worries me, but when you're outscoring everyone else in the country by 10 points a game, like, you're doing something very right. TCU has had some early in the year they look kind of sloppy, but it seems like they're getting over that, and their defense is improving. I think I'd go with the Frogs, but I think it's very close between those two teams, and luckily we'll have that wonderful Friday night game later in November to figure that all out. So overall, I think it was they were pretty close. I just think Alabama being four is pretty hard to defend when you're actually looking at existing results rather than what you think will end up happening, because I think we'll end up with Alabama winning the SEC if I had to bet. But I think that's what I would go with right now. But it's not easy because of how every team has some major flaw in their resume, pretty much, aside from Clemson and LSU, I guess. So hopefully things will figure themselves out, although chaos would also be fun. You brought up Utah. I wrote about them as one sleeper earlier this week, and I almost think, like, if Utah gets back on track, I mean, that USC loss, you know, it wasn't pretty, but USC is a super talented team. You can kind of explain that one away if Utah winds up winning the Pac-12. Kind of similar to what you can do with Stanford, who you could almost call Stanford the Ohio State, this team, because they lost to a gritty Northwestern
early
in the year.
Who, the Wildcats are the, I mean, that's the thing, and I said it earlier, the Wildcats are a good team. Trojans are a good team. These are better teams than the Virginia Tech team that Ohio State lost to last year at home.
Yeah. So that, I mean, there's so much that can happen. I think there's legitimately, like, I wouldn't count out any of the top 20 teams right now. I just think we don't know enough about the playoff, and we know too much about college football to do that, just because we've seen two lost BCS champions before. So I'm excited to see it play out. This weekend's great, like you said. A number of just, like, Alabama LSU, just obviously one of the pinnacle games of the season based on what's happened so far. Notre Dame Pitt should be really interesting, because Pitt always plays them tough and should really throw a wrench. And I mean, it would become close to ending Notre Dame's playoff hopes, and would throw another, would make the Coastal even more interesting than it already is, which is kind of silly to say, but true. So yeah, this should be, I mean, after a couple weeks that weren't great on paper, but ended up being pretty interesting, I think this one has a chance to be both.
Yeah.
Also, why is Utah 1.5-point dog at Washington?
And this is why I'm skeptical of Baylor, although I'm pretty sure that was a holding penalty.
Oh, there's the flag.
I think you're like a second behind me.
Yep. As soon as you said it, he was like just hitting the hole just opened up. So clearly, you being closer to the Midwest is obviously why you're ahead.
Yeah, you know what? I think the demarcation line for who's still in this is probably 16 is kind of the floor. I don't buy any of the two lost teams as being able to get themselves back in it enough, if only because there's so many undefeated and one loss teams in front of them. I think, like I was saying, Northwestern's probably an 8-win team. I see them finishing potentially second in the Big Ten West. Depends on what Wisconsin does. And then I see, USC probably finishing second in the Pac-12 South, all things considered. I think that they can probably suffer a loss to UCLA, maybe another one along the way. And still, I think they have enough tiebreakers to do some damage there and fairly finish second. Right now, I think the top two are dead on considering what we've seen. I don't really have any qualms with Ohio State, though I'd prefer they weren't there at this juncture. I think those three teams right now are fine. And then a fourth is probably TCU or Michigan State as of right now. And again, I don't really think you can make an argument against any of these, you know, undefeated squads right now. Down the road, I think Clemson, I think if Stanford runs through the table, I think Stanford's your number one, even with one loss. Of course, unless LSU wins out. I don't see LSU winning out. So I think Stanford's your number one. I think Clemson's your two as an unbeaten. I think LSU's your three as the SEC champ. And I think your four is the winner of the Ohio State-Michigan State game. I have a feeling that the Big 12 is going to get screwed again, whether or not they... whether or not they have an unbeaten or not, I have a bad feeling about what happens next. And of course, the funny part is, and I'm gonna have to go too far down this rabbit hole, is imagine if the Big 12 had decided to expand after last season and invited UCF. Imagine what would be happening right now if UCF was in waiting to go to the Big 12 after the season they're having right now.
They might pull like a reverse TCU and pull it. Like, we're on second thought.
We'll take Memphis and Houston.
If they get
Memphis and
again,
Houston are headed to the Big 12.
If they get left out again, when are the invites going out? Like December, 8th?
I think the night that the rankings are released.
They just invite, Cincinnati, Houston, BYU, whoever else, Memphis, to like some kind of a soiree and kind of a make it like a dinner for schmucks thing where they judge them and figure out who they dislike the least as a group.
I could very well see that happening.
Yeah, they need to. I'd have a lingering worry if I was the Big 12 because of this. Like, it's just so there's just no guarantee that the way they scheduled, they could very easily like devour themselves again. Like the back ended scheduling, it's going to be a lot of fun for us as non Big 12 fans. All the games are in the last 4 weeks.
No,
it's crazy.
There are two rules of college football if you're looking for a championship. Rule number one, don't lose. Rule number two, if you're going to lose, lose early.
Yep.
And for the Big 12 to laugh at both of these concepts.
All right, wait. What is going on with this kickoff? What the hell was that? Did they just onside kick from the opposing 30?
I'm confused.
What? I missed like why they were kicking off from there. How many penalties were there? That was crazy.
I always forget how big McGowan is, and it's always terrifying.
Like, if you're listening to this a day after.
So whatever happens here. Hopefully K-State upset, because be honest. This is exposing some things with Baylor's defense that we haven't seen up until this point. I mean, they're...
Mostly that you can go on a 9-minute drive against them.
They're getting carved up right now.
Yeah, the problem is they score every drive. Like... That makes
still,
up.
I mean,
it's 31-17.
Yeah, it's 31-17 in the fourth quarter. They are very likely going to fall short of 50 points. I mean, I don't even know if they're going to score 40 here.
It will hit their 60 point average a bit. But it's also Kansas State and Manhattan. Like, I didn't expect Kansas State to come too close, but it's not the easiest place to play. There's always some weird stuff that happens there, like that. That Auburn near upset last year.
Yeah, I think if you're going to have some Bill Snyder wizard magic, this was kind of the last shot at it this season, in my book.
It might be the last shot for a while. I don't know. I'd be almost surprised at this point if Bill Snyder's touching this team next year.
Really? I mean, obviously he's just going to retire because his name's on the building.
Yeah, no, he's not going to go anywhere else.
That's
it. It feels like that. Like Kansas State just... Some of the way they've lost games, like they just don't have like what these other previous Kansas State teams have had. Like in terms of, it just seems like a team that could use a spark of some sort.
Like what?
But I also don't know what's going. I mean, he could also end up coaching like 10 more years. So you never know with him.
My thing with K-State is like, I mean, I just think that they fall to the bottom of the list in terms of P5 jobs that would be up for grabs. And I think you need to bring in somebody with like. That gets the culture there. And I just don't know if there's too many guys that can do. I know one guy who would understand the culture there. I'm not going to bring it up for fear of what happens on Twitter next.
It's such a strange profile where they have had this pretty solid success for a long time, aside from the years that were pre and post Snyder. But the way he builds teams is so different than pretty much every other school in the country. And there's just no natural recruiting ground, as Kansas will tell you. It would be a real worry. But then there's also, like obviously he wants his son to be to get the job. That'd be like if Penn State had hired Paterno's son. Like, yeah, he's on the staff, but he's, you know, there's nothing that says he's anything more than the coach's son. So they're in a weird spot. So maybe he hangs on for as long as he can just to try to get them into a place where maybe they'll be a little more attractive. But Kansas State, definitely not the most attractive job because you're doing all of the following a legend, having to take over a job where there's like a very unique situation in terms of recruiting, and expectations are not crazy high, but they're not low. So that would be a very interesting opening. And I don't know how it would really factor in to a year that's already full of them. But I guess we'll see. Obviously, nothing's been said, but it almost seems like they just have been pretty flat this year and similar, not too dissimilar from what we've seen from like South Carolina this year.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good comparison. I guess last question, then we can probably wrap up the podcast. Shit, what was I going to say? Oh, I remember now. Nebraska. I feel like bringing up Kansas State. Kansas State has a very odd way of building a program, and I feel like it was based in part on what Nebraska did for a long time, and that is, you know, no local recruiting ground. They had a lot more success and a lot more cachet involved, but in general, you know, Nebraska's done a lot of JUCO recruiting. I think that in general, there's a different way to go about it. There's a different way to attract talent. I mean, they do recruit well. I think much better than Kansas State has. But 10 years from now, where do you see the Cornhuskers as a program?
Oh, that's tough. They're still holding on to a name that was built in the 90s, which, you know, it's not like they're the only school. We see similar things with Miami. They have some decent recent success, but obviously they expect a lot more. I think that the move to the Big Ten, I won't outright say it was a bad idea. I get it. I think it's hard to not say – it's hard to say that it wasn't the right thing to do. But Nebraska's recruiting was very Big 12-focused. Like, they got a lot of Texas kids and a lot of kids that were playing from that area of the country. And the Big 10 and the Big 12 just, like, geographically, it's just not – they're not similar. Like, they're not as far apart as, like, you know, the ACC and the Pac-12, but just very different styles and different – like, the teams just – across the board. The recruiting areas are totally different, so – it forces Nebraska to do more like stuff in Florida, which every team tries to do. And then you have a guy like Pelini, who was, you know, not burning the world, setting the world on fire, but you know, obviously all the jokes were about him being 9-4 every year. But 9-4 is not like the worst.
I'd kill for 9-4.
I'd be great. I'd be great with that. And they hire Mike Riley, which was a really questionable hire at the time. But you figured at least, you know, he seems like a guy who could maintain some momentum, and it's totally fallen off a cliff. So I think it's hard to say you should fire a coach after 1 year, like a lot of the Nebraska fans are. But like we talk about with Schaefer sometimes, like Riley was definitely – he wasn't from Nebraska. He wasn't a guy from Pelini's staff or anything, but like he was the guy that was hired to elevate where Nebraska was, because Pelini literally had the same record pretty much every single year, almost to a T. They weren't hiring Mike Riley to go 9-4. They hired him to try to,
which he'd only done with Oregon State once.
Yeah. Which, yeah. So, and you could say, you know, Oregon State doesn't have the same cachet as Nebraska, so maybe he can do better things here. He was also an older coach. It wasn't like he had these like crazy schemes or anything. And there were extenuating circumstances with Pelini as well.
I mean, yeah, he didn't get along with the Boosie. He didn't get along with the athletic director. There was nothing that kept him.
Yeah, all of that. But, like, it's hard to say that the Riley hire was anything but a disaster right now, because, like, even if you fell behind by a win and you're set, you can sell that it's an adjustment and they'll get back to where they were and higher a year or two down the road. But when you go from 9-4 all the time to 3-6,
likely 4-8.
You know, are they going to beat Iowa? Yeah, like are they? They might finish with 4 wins. Like that. That's one situation where you can almost understand where fans will start to want to fire the coach after 1 year, because he's also not a very high. Like he doesn't seem like a huge high upside hire either. So Nebraska's in a really strange situation. Obviously, their AD is now in some turmoil along with Riley, because that was his guy. I would almost be surprised at this point if there weren't sweeping changes there in the next 2 years, just because I don't look at that team and see one that's getting. I mean, obviously they've had some awful luck in terms of how some of the games have ended this year, but eventually, you know, 3-6, you can explain away a couple games, but it's not like they've been blowing the doors off the teams in the wins. So yeah, that's an iffy situation for sure.
Yeah, I'm stunned at what's transpired there, but not as much so after the Riley hire. I think that Nebraska presents a really interesting situation. They're one of those handful of teams that might be better off as an independent, to be perfectly honest. Like, they're just not. I mean, you brought it up perfectly. Like, the recruiting stuff is much bigger than I think they ever thought. You're not going to be able to convince these kids in the Midwest who you're recruiting out of Chicago and Indianapolis and Detroit and Milwaukee and all these other, like, not big cities, but I mean, Chicago is. But in general, like, these larger cities, like, when you were in the Big 12, you're recruiting from, hey, kid in the middle of nowhere in Kansas or Oklahoma or Nebraska or Iowa or Texas. Do you want to leave the middle of nowhere and come to middle of nowhere over here? Like, that's one sell versus, like, now it's, hey, kid who's in Chicago, do you want to leave Chicago and, you know, not play at Notre Dame or not play at Ohio State or not play at Michigan? You want to come play in, you know, middle of nowhere in Nebraska? Like, middle of nowhere can sell if you're, you know, banking on success. But the last Nebraska team to really matter gets smoked in the Fiesta Bowl. Or was it the Fiesta Bowl or was it the Orange Bowl? Whichever game that they lost by a million points to Miami in.
I think that was the Orange Bowl.
Either way, that was a long time ago. Nebraska is in a really tenuous spot. I think if there was, not that I think it will happen, but if there was one team in the entire country out of those that shook out in the realignment fiasco of the last few years, if there's one team that probably wanted to go back and I could see going back to where it was, it would be Nebraska. And I feel like that's the main reason why the Big 12 isn't moving faster on getting new teams in.
Yeah, I don't know. The other thing is that we don't ever hear, like, even the slightest whisper about that outside of, like, maybe a fan saying, hey, let's go back to the Big 12. So I don't see it happening. I just think there's, like, kind of a, you know, you can't put a pin back in the grenade type thing with conference realignment. But if you asked, like, off the record, if some of the principals there would want to undo what they've done, you know, obviously you're going to make more money in the Big Ten eventually once their ridiculous stipulations go up, but definitely probably a more, even if not more winnable in the Big 12, like, Nebraska had a pretty good thing going there for a while, outside of, like, and when Nebraska wasn't good, it was because they made, like, a bad hire. But in the Big Ten, it seemed like they had a definite ceiling, and they clearly weren't happy with that ceiling, and now they're finding that the floor is not all that high either. So being a Nebraska fan, while you're probably a very pleasant person and have seen a lot of good football, I can understand why they're kind of getting pretty ravenous based on the whole situation.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Oh, you're definitely.
Once again, reacting to a game in real time where Kansas State suddenly has Baylor on the ropes.
Oh, Bill Snyder, yeah. Wizard magic. The what is it with magic and teams from the Missouri and Kansas area?
I don't know. This is that's a really nice catch.
Yep. I don't know how he hung down.
I honestly think the sleeves helped.
No idea. Yes, John is the resident Baylor hater of podcast. I have no particular animus.
No, honestly, I hate Baylor.
And I appreciate
the I hate Baylor because I hate, well, one, as anyone who has listened to me in either my college football or college basketball talk, I hate Nouveau Riche fan bases. And I hate, I think most of it's I hate Nouveau Riche fan bases. And on my old site once, I wrote an article saying, like, just joking around about, like, crazy ways in which realignment would never happen but could. And I think somebody posted a link on a Baylor site to one of my articles and basically, like, called me every name under the sun for an article that in the first paragraph says, this isn't happening, nor is it any realistic. And for some reason, I use that as my jumping off point to disliking Baylor.
Fair enough. I mean, they were almost once kicked out of the Big 12, so I can kind of see where they'd be a little emotional about that.
I'd agree. So this podcast is well over an hour now, and we haven't really mentioned Syracuse the last 30 minutes, so it might be time to call it a day. But Dan, as always, really appreciate you coming on. We had a fun time, as always.
Yeah. And I'd like to point out before we go, and I will not have any more comment towards it because I didn't see any of it, but it took Clemson basketball 2 overtimes to beat something called Lenoir or Lenoir Rhine in an exhibition. So ACC basketball
that's,
coming at you.
That's at least a win. We know we've got one this year.
I'll try to find out how to pronounce that school by next week.
That was Dan. I'm John. This was Troy Noons, an Absolute Podcast. Be sure to rate, review, subscribe on Blog Talk, on iTunes, and go Orange this weekend.
Go Orange. Go Orange.